After that introduction, I feel like starting.
When I was last in this room in 1781, but I might stretch it a bit too far. I'm going to do what theologians don't do very often, or perhaps nearly never, and that is to talk to you about sin. And I imagine that the reason that they don't do it very often is that they want to avoid conforming to a supposed popular stereotype in which they never do anything else. But talking about sin and learning how to talk about sin theologically is actually quite important to the way we think about our moral engagements as Christians. To speak of sin is to speak of evil. And there is a logic of speaking of evil. In speaking of evil, we speak of what the theological tradition has always insisted has no being. In combating the Manichaean belief in two rival and competing first principles of good and evil, respectively, the fathers of the church insisted, first, there is no alternative God. And there is no alternative creation. And therefore, there is no alternative reality. There is only the denial of the reality that there really is, the reality that God has made. And that denial is a kind of subtraction from that reality which those who refuse that reality impose upon themselves. Listen to the great 7th century Byzantine theologian Maximus Confessor. Evil never was, never is, and never will be a subsistent with a nature of its own. It has nothing by way of substance or nature or subsistence or potency or operation among things that really are. Nor is it a quality or a quantity or a relation or a place or a time or a purpose or an effect or a motion or a disposition or an experience to be situated within the nature of things that have being. Nor in the whole sum of things does it subsist in its own natural identity as a beginning, a continuation, or an end. But, to put it briefly, as he adds at that point, evil is a failure. A failure of the operation of powers immanent to any nature by which it attains its end. And apart from that, it's nothing at all. And what on those terms can we say of sin? Well, sin arises within the sphere of human action, but is not an alternative action. It can only be a failure of action. As there is no alternative God, no alternative reality, so there is no alternative action, only failure of action. By which we mean, of course, not merely the failure to achieve our own subjective ends, as when I try to kill my enemy but my hand slips, but a failure to attain the objective ends that God has created us as acting beings to attain. The devotion of our energy and intelligence to the praise of God and to the service of his kingdom. As when I hate my enemy because I fail to see in him the lost child of God that he really is. Now many people, when they hear this proposition about sin as failure, suppose that it is meant as a kind of palliation or general excuse for sin, an unwillingness to take sin seriously. For myself, I see it as the only way of taking sin seriously, as offence to God. There are other ways of taking sin seriously. Milton's Satan illustrates one of them. For him, sin becomes the occasion for heroic self-esteem. Milton's Satan is the original Manichaean, we might say. He believes in the possibility of an alternative reality, an alternative scale of values, an alternative God, who will, of course, be him. And within that alternative universe, God will have no right to be offended at Satan for doing his own thing in his own way. On this construction, failure is something quite different from sin. Sin is achievement, not failure. Failure is much inferior to sin, so inferior we may say that it's hardly worth noticing. And so the question of offence to God gets neatly circumvented on two sides. You can step either to the left or to the right of it. On the one hand, sin, real sin, is too dignified for God to take offence at it. Satan's kind of sin. Whereas on the other hand, failure, Adam's kind of failure, is too insignificant and unimportant for God to take offence at it. The agent who rebels reduces God's wrath to impotence. The agent who merely stumbles does not rise to its notice. Now, in reaching this highly satisfactory conclusion, an important role is played by an idea that I shall call loosely voluntarism. That's one of those contested words, and I'd better tell you how I use it. I use it to mean the idea that the only issues of moral importance are the free choices of an unencumbered will. Pick up any treatise of moral theology from an earlier generation, some earlier generations, and you're likely to find a very sharp distinction made between sin and what is called imperfection. And you'll form the impression, I think, from them that it's very difficult indeed to commit a real sin, a real honest-to-badness sin, worthy of the name of sin. Thomas Slater's Manual of Moral Theology, for example, from 1925, lays it down that for a sin to be committed, it requires that one always apprehends that he is doing a wrong action, an action which his conscience condemns, with actual advertence to the malice of the action done, either when the action is performed or when the cause is put, that is to say, the act is conceived, and to this demanding psychological condition for sinning, a yet more demanding condition is added, free consent of the will. Not merely, that is, consent to the sinful act one happens to be committing, but consent to the outright wrong one is supposed to be aware one is doing in willing it. So, it's not merely that I think of a screamingly funny story to tell which is highly derogatory to a colleague and puts that colleague in a ridiculous light and find the story irresistible and tell it. What I've got to find irresistible is the actual thought that I am wronging my colleague. Without that, I'm not sinning at all. So the thief, who has never learned to distinguish meum from tuum, the kleptomaniac, powerless to resist, these, according to Slater, are mere inadequates. Not sinners. They're not clear-sighted, steely-nerved, freely consenting to the wrong they're doing. So rather few of us, I think, qualify as sinners on that account, since so much of our wrongdoing, in fact, is a matter of not understanding not attending, not finding things out. And that is part of the attraction of voluntarism. It allows us, with a certain grandeur, to dismiss our sins with a shrug of contempt. Mere mistakes, as though God could be thought so mean as to interest himself in little faults like those. So if voluntarism is a charter for moral excuses, it's especially useful, and this is its real attraction, I think, when we imagine that moral thinking is all about forming judgments on other people's sins. The moral theology of Slater's generation used to think of itself as a kind of judicial science. The priest or pastor sitting in the confessional or the counselling room was there to pass judgment. And therefore, of course, as anybody who passes judgment does, it made a special point of mitigating the severity of the moral law wherever it possibly could. Of course it wanted to be generous to putative sinners, to listen to excuses wherever possible, to set high conditions for bringing their sins into its court. And of course, there is undeniable truth in all that. When morality is put to pastoral uses, when it has to do with reaching a view on what other people have done, failures can be viewed more charitably, more wisely, if we will listen carefully to excuses. To comprendre, rend très indulgent. But as soon as we turn from thinking first about other people's sins to thinking about our own sins, then this whole excusatory line of thought becomes quite irrelevant. The plea, "I couldn't help it," gets me nowhere, since my whole problem is that, as a matter of fact, I didn't help it. Whether I could have done or not is of academic interest. My awareness of sin comes down to this. I meant to do good. I thought I was doing good. And lo and behold, I did mischief. My purposes miscarried. Either I lacked the strength to do the good I intended to do, or the circumstances were too much for me. The one way, I misjudged myself. I overestimated my good intentions. The other way, I misjudged the world I had to act in. In the face of that misjudgment, nothing else matters very much. I am, as the poet of the 119th Psalm liked to express it, put to shame. Now, a voluntarist tradition of morality has created a fashion of disregarding shame as a sub-moral emotion. In my own view, it is deeply revelatory of the nature of sin as offence against God. Now, there are two complementary but quite distinct ways of talking about sin that you will encounter in theology. There is what I loosely call the dogmatician's thesis of the necessity of sin, and there is the moralist's thesis of the possibility of sin. Let us, as Barth taught us we must, locate them against a simple statement of the gospel. God calls us to be human agents from failure to restored agency, from sin to service. And the dogmatician's thesis takes off from the words "from failure God calls us." The movement is not in the other direction, he tells us. It's not a fall. We don't start out effective agents and land up stumbling into failure. It's a redemption. It moves from failure to effectiveness. Sin, then, is always presupposition. It's behind us. It's where we started from. The dogmatician's sin, in that sense, is, as the phrase goes, original. It's sin located in our origin as agents. And since sin is where we necessarily start from, it's a presupposition common to our human agency, without exception, without qualification. The dogmatician's sin is also, to use a now slightly outdated term, racial. That is bound up with our membership of the human race. Not, to be sure, in its creation and its possibilities, but in its historical actuality. Differences in human sin are of little interest to the dogmatician. And of especially minor interest is any attempt to categorize sins according to their varying degrees of severity. What matter, in the light of God's redemption, if the failure of human agency in a given case is great or small? Whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become accountable for all. James 2:10. For those in need of redemption, there are only two categories of acts that count. And it's as true of sins as it is of good works that, as Luther said, all works become equal. One work is like the other. All distinctions fall away, whether great, small, short, long, many, or few. The dogmatician has no interest in an exploratory description of sins. Always behind us, always a presupposition of our humanity, sin can safely remain a mystery to dogmatics, a senseless contradiction of the claim of God, of which no rational account ever could be given or ever should be attempted. Now, we can go a long way with this, I think, and yet see that there is something else that must be said about sin, which, rightly understood, will be complementary, not contradictory, to what the dogmatician wants to tell us about original sin. And this, it is the responsibility particularly of the moral theologian to say. Start from the same statement of the gospel and throw the emphasis elsewhere. From failure, God calls us to restored agency. God's call is not a predetermination that we can do nothing about, a necessitation. It's a command. It's an invitation. It's issued to our freedom. It requires a response involving our intelligent assent to God's purpose that we should leave failure behind and claim our agency anew from Him. And moral theology, which must always speak second in the order of theology after dogmatics, must point especially to the character of the response that is required to this call. It has to tell us that it is almost possible that we may fail to respond to God's summons. That's an implication of our being free. And it has to tell us, therefore, that sin is not only a presupposition, something lying behind us, but a possibility, something that lies ahead of us as well as behind us. Not ahead of us as a necessity, but as a real and present danger. Sin crouches at the door, as God said to Cain. And that's a word of some encouragement to sinners, one might think, since it would surely have been true for Cain, if it had been true for anybody, that his sin was now behind him, his decision made once and for all, his goose well and truly cooked, and yet God persisted in addressing him as he addresses all whom he summons out of sin, warning him of the sin that lay ahead, crouching at the door. Not a fixed and determined sin like his sin against Abel, but open either to succumb or to escape from. And this is the possible sin I propose that phrase as a rather better opposite to the term original sin than the one the tradition has often used, which is actual sin. So moralists talk of possible sins. And if we're talking about sin ahead of us, crouching at the door, we need to be able to recognise it. We need to be able to describe it in the variety of forms it may present. Now, we must, of course, be careful and modest here. A description of sin is not an attempt to grade types of sin according to their severity. It doesn't contradict the quantitative principle of James 2:10. We may sometimes need to grade moral faults by their severity, but only if we're called upon to give judgment, which, if we're to believe Jesus of Nazareth, most of us, most of the time, are not. But we are at least required to recognise the forms in which sin offers itself to us as possible. We may sin by being unfeeling. We may sin by being stupid. We may sin by being hasty. We may sin by being insecure, and so on, and so on. Effective agency is an articulated, complex movement, a journey of practical thought in which failure can occur at more than one point. For voluntarism, decision is all one movement, a single moment. We pull the trigger of the will, as it were. The gun of decision goes off, never mind in what direction, because what counts is the explosion of the gunpowder. But for the serious marksman, it matters whether the barrel is lined up with the bullseye, whether the handhold is steady, whether the timing is exact, and so on, and so on. Now, because we have other things to concern us tonight, you're going to have to be content with a very bold statement from me at this point, that human agency is essentially a threefold movement which involves, first, ourselves as agents, second, the world into which we act, and thirdly, the moment of time that affords our opportunity. Restored by the renewing work of the Holy Spirit, this threefold movement is characterized as faith, love, and hope. Now, there's much to be said in explanation of that bold remark, which I'm not going to be able to say tonight. I just want to assume it and go on. A description of sin will begin from the possibility of failure in each of these three moments of our agency. A failure of faith, a failure of love, a failure of hope, a sin against the agent self, a sin against the world, a sin against time. And from each of these focal points, there opens up a vista of further possible specifications, different ways in which we may sin against, stretching to the imagination's horizon. But here, any kind of theoretical account has to know its limits. I'm always suspicious of moral theologies which have too elaborate a taxonomy of sin attached to them, because discernment of occasions of sin is primarily a business of exploration in life. The believer who seeks to find a way forward in faithful action may see a temptation lying to one side or the other of that way forward, and may tell us about it and warn us of it. And the moral teacher who guides others in finding their ways can point out certain characteristic temptations of the setting or the age. The testimony in either case will refer to the cultural contexts in which these discernments are made. Unfamiliarity of context may make the testimony quite puzzling. When we read, for instance, of the conscientious anxieties experienced by many believers in the 4th century AD about singing hymns, or among 19th century pietists about reading novels, we find ourselves quite embarrassed. Yet Morality is not a progressive science. The words, "today, of course, we know better," which always tend to hover on our lips when presented with an embarrassment from history, ought to be choked back. They are always mistaken when applied to some moral testimony. And if we can listen to these testimonies with respect, acknowledging not only that the people who give them were limited, as we are limited, but also that there's a cultural gulf limiting our understanding of them, then they may help us attune our sensibilities to the concrete temptations that face us quite peculiarly in our own time and setting. But to discern these is something that's given to us in our time to do, and to help one another do. No treatise by Thomas Aquinas or Calvin will tell us of the moral threats we face in Britain today, and future historians looking back will certainly mock us for whatever those threats are, for they will not be their threats. A grand theory of all possible sins cannot be formed. Yet none of this implies, I think, that there's nothing for moral theology to do in terms of mapping out sin and general description. For there is the underlying structure of sin which corresponds to the underlying structure of faithful action. And its recurrent forms can be illustrated, and the possibilities that open up from them can at least be pointed out with examples. And this provides us with a framework in which we can approach our own decisions and one another's decisions intelligently. So let us say then that there is a sin against the self, a sin against the world, a sin against time. Let us give them their names, the names they have traditionally had in the tradition. We speak of doubt, of folly, and of despair. Now, all sins are against God. They defy the reality, his reality as creator, sustainer, and redeemer of goods. But we should not follow Peter Abelard's dictum, which is, in effect, the very essence of voluntarism, that the only true sin is contempt of God, meant directly and explicitly as such. As our relation to our Creator and Redeemer is mediated in life and action through nature and time, so it is with our failure to relate to him. Our sins, indeed, are contempt of God. But we're not capable of defying God outright and directly, as Milton imagined Satan as doing. We are capable only of forgetting him by forgetting what he has made, what he has done, what he has said, as Adam and Eve forgot him. We may forget ourselves as agents. We may forget created goods within the world. We may forget the moment of time in which we find ourselves called on to act. Self, world, time are the dimensions in which the good of agency is set, and these dimensions are aspects of the good of created human action. So when we name and order our sins, we don't make things out of them. We merely locate sins as failures to respond to these different forms of created goodness, as one might locate a hole in the road. Now, the rest of what I want to say this evening is about the sin against the self. I can't talk about all three fundamental types of sin, so I'm concentrating on this first of the major three. God calls us to answer for ourselves. He calls us to agency, to do things. We can know ourselves without feeling called to do things. At the level of purely animal life, we can know ourselves to be at any one moment comfortable or uncomfortable. At the level of existence, we can know ourselves to be anxious or to be satisfied and content. But agency is the exercise of freedom, and freedom is our responsibility for disposing of our action. To know ourselves as agents is to know that we're free, not mere chess pieces on someone else's board, and to know at the same time that that doesn't mean that we're fancy free. The conditions within which we can act freely are given us in certain definite possibilities, challenges, opportunities, and it is to these that our freedom must respond, whether we like them or not. And it is to know that how we respond to them determines our final welfare. Success and failure lie before us in life. We may win our souls or lose them. Our responsibility, then, is formed outside us and born within us. We're responsible in relation to the world and time, but responsible by virtue of something within us that must answer to the Spirit of God for what we have done with ourselves. This is a moment, this answering, that constantly enchants the poets of ancient Israel. The agent self emerges from anonymity and hiddenness to take its stand before God in answer to his voice. "Thou hast said, seek ye my face," a poet declares. And in response to that divine invitation addressed in the plural, "Seek ye my face," he steps forward to announce himself in the first person singular. "My heart says to thee, thy face, Adonai, do I seek." And another psalmist, similarly, suddenly self-aware, cries, "Bless Adonai my soul." At one and the same moment, he grasps the object of his blessing, Adonai, he is, and my soul, whose readiness to bless is the proof of his own agency. And with that cry of recognition of God as to be blessed, he leaps also to self-recognition too. "There could have been no discourse with my soul, no talk of what is within me, before that exclamation, bless Adonai." Impressions, sensations, feelings, impulses, all the events that flit across the surface of a consciousness are like shadows across a stone. They come, they go. But now something else happens. They come together to constitute a me. A culture that's lost sight of Adonai, he is, has also, and necessarily as a result of that, lost sight of me. The comic actor Peter Sellers once said, "There used to be a real me, but I had it removed by surgical operation." Spoke for the whole of his age. There is more than he is and my soul. Together with the self and God, there is the world too involved in the very act of articulating praise, because the poet goes straight on, "and forget not all his benefits." Successive self-givings of the world's original comprise a story of goodness unfolding on earth. Benefits to be recalled and narrated by a poetic self that has now been granted its own identity in the act of remembering and recounting. The elementary type of the sin against the self, then, is a refusal of this summons. We declare ourselves to be really non-agents, mere passive creatures of events beyond our control, more sinned against than sinning. That declaration cannot be an honest mistake. It's not possible for us to deny our agency persuasively, to see ourselves quite strictly as non-agents. We continue to live our lives. We work, we rest, we love, we hate. Above all, we resent and blame. Stones on the hillside do not resent the meteorological forces that threw them there. But we, nursing our agency secretly within us, pretend to find fault with what we have come to be. Ere nescience shall be reaffirmed, how long, the poet Thomas Hardy presumed to ask, rather grandly, a wholly insincere question, because nobody could ask about nescience without an interest in something very different from nescience, unconsciousness. The self without faith cannot deny itself any more than it can affirm itself. Through the gift of faith, the Holy Spirit's restoring and recovering of our agency, we can claim possession of the self that we always were and could never be completely unmindful, but always felt a need to suppress and deny. This failure of faith the scripture describes as doubt. Let him ask in faith. That's the first word of the most practical of apostles, St. James, who continues, "He who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind." What is it that we doubt? We doubt ourselves, and we doubt God who offers us ourselves. And as such, doubt is the radical sin, the sin that undermines action at its root, burying the talent in a napkin for fear of the mistakes we may make if we venture onto the exchange of action. Now, feminist thinkers have often highlighted this sin, seeing it as a typically feminine fault, which I beg leave to doubt, though I think there are some typically feminine forms of this fault, as there are typically masculine ones. But it's a mistake which feminist thinkers have sometimes made to confuse this doubt of self with self-sacrifice. Acts of self-sacrifice do not shrink from agency. They seize it. When we deliberately forego some good that is accessible to us, precisely in order that we may better serve God or the neighbour, then we affirm ourselves as agent. Failures of faith are those that evade decision. Doubt is ambivalence. "My just one shall live by faith," says the Epistle to the Hebrews, quoting Habakkuk. "But if he shrinks back, my soul has no delight in him." On the one hand, we can understand this doubt as a kind of self-protectiveness, withholding something from the dangers of the outer world. "Something we were withholding made us weak," Robert Frost wrote sonorously. What exactly is it that we withhold when we doubt? We withhold service. Service to God, service to others. And that makes us weak, because God has made it a condition of any practical strength that it should be exercised for others and for him. But withholding is not only self-protectiveness, it is also more profoundly a refusal to accept our role. And that is a sin against God and against ourselves. Doubt may be the sin of self-display and striking poses. Augustine often spoke of a bad self-love. Self-love to the contempt of God, he called it, which is at the same time both self-hatred, seen from another point of view, and self-complacency. It is clinging to an ideal and fantasized self-image, which we will not let go in order to receive and discover the real self that God would give us. Luther's well-known description of sin as the incurvatus in se, self-enclosure, captures this vicious circularity very well. Where true self-love responds to a summons to realize itself in obedience, bad self-love clings to the self-made self. Self-assertive in its manner, its motive is diffident and doubting, for it has an insatiable thirst to be reassured by others' admiration. The doubter lives on other people's gaze. The doubter is not the miser who hides his wealth from the eyes of his fellows. The doubter is the spender, the party thrower, the householder of the elegant mansion with the manicured gardens, the garrulous hogger of conversations, the exhibitionist. These are all the doubters needing these friable materials into a self-image that God would replace with a self cast in the strong metal of spirit. Doubt is a predatory relation to the world. Its inner resources are overleveraged. It cannot face a course of action that requires obscurity or public rejection. Within that very broad characterization of the sin against the self, let me take just a few soundings across a spectrum between two poles, the immediate and the reflective. At one end, doubt may implode into a flurry of agitation. At the other, it may subside into sluggish inertness. First of all, indecision, the simple incapacity to hold a firm course, the tendency to ricochet from one thing to another, always looking over the shoulder, always hedging every decision as soon as it's been made. He who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind, as James says. One mark of indecision is that we are swallowed up in the natural oscillation of feelings, mood swings that tack and bluff between self-vaunting and self-depreciation, between the worship of fortune and the worship of fate, depriving us of all practical purchase on ourselves. From being anxious or secure, dead clods of sadness, or light squibs of mirth, good Lord, deliver us. That's John Donne. Why does shrinking from action take this oscillating, bipolar form of depression and hyperactivity? Doubting is failure to engage. When the world becomes an object with which we lack engagement, there's no objective control on the moods we experience. The poles arise not from encountering the world, but from failing to encounter the world. They are, as it were, the revolutions of the emotional engine out of gear, responding to pressure from the accelerator, but with nothing to thrust against. Oversensibility for feeling can thus become an obstacle to real accomplishment and real joy. Now, it lies beyond the sphere of ethics to pursue questions of causation in this area. We know very well that mood instability can be a function of biochemical irregularity, irregularities of blood pressure, that it can be caused by genetic inheritance, by external stimulations, and that it is sometimes responsive to medical intervention. Just the same can be said of the great achievements. Intelligence, too, is genetically conditioned, and the sportsman's adrenaline flow is helped by an enthusiastic crowd. Bipolar mood swings offer no greater mystery than the familiar one surrounding all our actions, the mystery that we are objects at the same time as we are subjects, products of causal sequences at the same time that we initiate causal sequences. And all that needs to be said in this instance is that we do, in fact, ordinarily take responsibility for our moods. When we're bored, we settle down to amuse ourselves. When we're lonely, we seek company. When excitement makes us giddy, we counsel one another to steady ourselves, and so on, and so on. Inconstancy of mood, because its immediacy is so great, is the form in which we're least likely to be deceived about our indecision. There are many less emotional ways of bluffing and tacking, many less evident evasions of agency, and some of them may even strike us as proofs of boldness. The politician abandons a long-cherished policy in order to cling to power. A university closes down a department it has spent generations building up. The allure of decisiveness may tempt us to cut loose from old decisions and always be making new ones, so that decisiveness becomes the precise mirror image of indecisiveness, the difference between them in practice indiscernible. No one makes a decision who cannot stand by a decision. A decision is truly made only when it is implemented and stuck to. Institutions have well-known patterns of decisive indecision. Policies carefully formed, quickly lost sight of. Long-term aims swallowed up in short-term tactics. Disciplines of consultation overridden by managerial fiat. Important records lost in the labyrinth of ephemeral documentation. Guidelines issued and reissued so frequently that not even the software can keep level with the latest edition. These are the reasons, small in themselves, vast in totality, why work in corporate contexts has become a crucifixion to so many who would like to give their best effort, but find they cannot. Now, indecision should not be confused with hesitation. Hesitation can also take the form of a mind wavering between alternatives. But hesitation is essentially caution, a proper claim laid upon time needed for a good decision, when the moment for resolving has to be waited on. If the pieces needed for a decision have not fallen into place, we hesitate because we understand what the action requires of us, and we shall be all the more ready to give it when the moment comes. The hesitant agent decides slowly, but definitely. The doubter decides quickly and to little effect. The hesitant agent is careful of what is uncertain, tries the ground before putting weight on it. The doubter treats everything as certain until 10 minutes later, when everything is still certain, but now with all the values reversed. So much for indecision. A second form of doubting, less volatile, is half-heartedness. In a complex understanding, it's very easy to lose interest in undertaking. It's very easy to lose interest in parts of it. Seated at a meeting, the details of which do not greatly interest us, we play quietly with a BlackBerry under the table, hoping to catch up on the football scores. Perhaps we're merely flagging, and a moment of refreshment will do us the world of good and bring our attention and concentration back to bear on the business once again. But perhaps we're engaged in a truculent form of power play. University administrators may keep whole departments under their thumb by such methods. And a generation or so ago, tales used to be told of professors who would attend to their correspondence in seminars while the students presented their ideas. Dividing attention is one way in which we express disdain. More deeply problematic are tasks begun with enthusiasm which we disdain to carry through. Every writer knows what it is to sit down to commit some burning thoughts to paper or to screen, and then to find the first result so disappointing that the paper is torn up or the file destroyed. The perfectionist cannot live in the tension of creativity and criticism. It's as though the artist in us is smothered at birth by the critic, never allowed to get far enough to profit from the criticism. Now, the world tells us to exercise some willpower in this context, and such advice is, as the world's advice usually is, merely a distraction. It's not a power that the perfectionist lacks. Some kind of furnace, which might perhaps be stoked up with a little bit of huffing and puffing. What is lacking is the simple confidence to say yes to a task and to do it as well or as badly as one's talents allow. It's not, of course, the questions of quality are irrelevant. If we know we have a task to perform, we shall think about what it may mean to perform it well. Jesus' twin parables of the man who would build a tower and the king who would go to war both focus on the need to think through what a task involves. The old proverb says, if a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing well, which warns us of a failure to deliberate, so that our performance is haphazard and shoddy. But the wit who turned it on its head and said, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly, identified a no less real failure, a failure to think about what it means to perform an act at all. The Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, by the way, tells us that that was G.K. Chesterton. Not improbably. I have no way of checking. Now let's pick a third point on this spectrum, resentment. And this takes us more deeply into detachment and inaction. Born of disappointment with ourselves, it's directed against all those who make us feel small, including, and sometimes singling out, those who have dealt very handsomely with us. The role imagination devised for me in my attempt to construct a self has not been realized. And for this ineffectiveness of mine, I hold God to blame, the world, and random inhabitants of the world. We assert our claim to agency while refusing our responsibility for a failure to satisfy ourselves. We thus put ourselves in the false position of one who merits pity. We assume the victim mentality, treating everything that's happened, especially other people's success, as a wrong that has been devised against us. Resentment originates in anger. Anger, as C.S. Lewis very nicely called it, is the anesthetic of the mind. Anger, too, places blame. But placing blame is not always a mistaken or an unhelpful response. If anger anaesthetizes the mind, it does so in order to overcome the shock of pain. And it does so for a short time, until sunset, as the apostle proposes, briskly. It paves the way within our minds for an active pursuit of justice, which is enough to show that though we may have been victimized, a victim is not what we are. The pursuit of justice draws us out of the one-sided grief to seek a fuller account of what wrong was done and how. It leads us, perhaps in the end, to the most positive action possible in the face of wrong, which is clear-headed, unsentimental forgiveness. Anger, given space to work itself through positively, may thus restore us to a capacity for action again. But its anesthetic properties can very easily become addictive. We may prefer to let it go smouldering on rather than be resolved. Because for all the emotional storms and the rather bitter taste in the mouth that anger stirs up within us, the sense it gives us of occupying moral high ground is not at all an unpleasant sense. Is it surprising that we should prefer not to climb down from our little eminence of outrage and get back to work? What prompts the convalescent to prefer the sick bed to recovered health? Doubt of self, doubt of a capacity to live. The offence is seized on for the great excuse it offers us of not putting our vocation to the test. The anaesthetic of the mind, I may add in passing, is also, in my view, this is merely a throwaway comment en route, is also an anaesthetic of art. Art is the making of artifacts in any medium that represent humanity back to itself. Romantic art, focusing on the revelatory power of suffering, exposed itself to a stubborn infection, an infection of self-pity that wound its way into a very great deal of literature and music in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Self-pity appeals to self-pity, and it achieves an éclat among those who cannot distinguish their own self-pity from moral seriousness. The duller critics look for the clenched fist, the conventional proof of a Prometheus come among them with fire. And to conclude, a fourth and final sounding, less plaintive, more ironic, and to that extent more habituated and entrenched. Moral detachment takes refuge from action in an observer's stance, watching the world go by, charting its progress. It may declare itself as cynical indifference, but alternatively, and perhaps more commonly, it may take an idealist form as totalized criticism, mounting such passionate and principled objections to every possible course of action or every possible reality that it has a perfect reason for doing nothing at all and can bask in the sense of uncontaminated moral principle. The idealist is not very different from the cynic, really. They both know too much about the world ever to risk living in it. Von Balthasar thought that the essence of all sin was gnosis, which he associated provocatively, especially with psychology and sociology. Intellectual perspectives bounded by observational science afford the ideal cultural form for an age that is cynical and idealist at the same time. When intellect refuses to become practical reason, when it entrenches itself in abstract and quasi-scientific schemas of explanation, it withholds itself from life. Kant knew that the road of natural necessity was much more travelled than the footpath of freedom. Von Balthasar's special reference to the human sciences should not be taken to suppose that these disciplines of learning, when undertaken with a clear appreciation of their function and competence, have nothing of importance to tell us about human affairs. They are, after all, simply part of the disciplined observations we make of one another. And practical reason can always make good use of disciplined observation. The target of criticism, rather, was a resort to the observational mindset as a default position, a knowing posture which offers a refuge from the demands of moral reflection, decision, and action. Student after student, incapable of an ordered sequence of thought, offers the university the research of his questionnaires and statistical analyses. And in this we see the bewitchment of scientism tightening its grip. To think about human behaviour without thinking how we humans are to behave is to install the point of view of a surveyor of opinions in place of responsibility for acting and living. it is the deepest and most intransigent refusal of the agent self. I stop there. Apologies for being a little long.
About being responsible for that versus being culpable and how that relates to sin.
Which is always the first thing a voluntarist wants to do. You'll pardon me. I want to say, can you give me an example of any sin that didn't involve a misjudgment? Either about the world or about the oneself. A sin that is absolutely pure of cognitive error, as it were. I've never been able to think of one. I mean, I think if one were to believe the voluntarists, then all our sins would be like that. All our real sins. Everything would be totally clear-sighted. We would be Satan, not Adam or Eve. And we are, in fact, Adam and Eve. That's who we are. How do we discriminate culpability and greater culpability and lesser culpability? Now, these are juridical concepts, right? You have taken us straight into the realm of judging one another, judging in court, judging for different purposes. And the answer has to be, it depends for which purposes you are judging. If you are judging for the purposes of assigning criminal liability or perhaps civil liability for a major accident, a child of four is not liable for whatever it is, knocking over the bowl of apples, which caused the horse to stumble, which caused the cart to crash into the building, which caused the building to fall, which caused people to be killed, so on. You can imagine. A child of four is, for certain purposes, simply not liable. But in the internal discipline of the family, a child of four is certainly liable for willfully knocking over a bottle of a bowl of apples. The child has to be told that he wasn't in control of himself and that he has done wrong within his own scope. So the same act done by the same person may be, as it were, not liable from one set of measurements and for certain social purposes and liable from another set of measurements for other social purposes. And so the absolute distinction between the two cannot be made. On the same reckoning, we are held in law more liable for civil damages than for criminal convictions. We may be found not guilty and still civilly liable in certain ways for certain acts. And they may refer to the same action, which can be viewed from the angle of from either angle. When we're talking about ourselves, which is the primary language of morality, talking about other people and judging other people is always secondary to that. When we're talking about ourselves, there is no real use for the exercise of excuse. That, it seems to me, is what one of the things the gospel sets us free from. We may need to give a palliating account or a justifying account of ourselves to other people, but when we simply ask about ourselves and say, we can say, I shouldn't have done that. And that may include accidents, may include not looking, may include simply not being aware of things. There will be gradations, as it were. Well, I might have found that out, but it would have been more difficult for me to find that out. There may well be gradations given on the particular bit of the story. But from our point of view, the only thing we need to know about ourselves is that we got it wrong.
End of story. Too simple?
Do you suppose that when we judge ourselves, it's a moral act, reflecting on, oh, I shouldn't have done that, do you think that there's a difference in how God may judge our action, looking at our intention? Or is he, maybe we may not know, but does he look at it similarly in the sense that you just set up here at the last portion of what you said?
God is, yes, God, as it were, God has a narrative to tell us. We do investigate what has gone wrong with our actions. Not, as it were, with the purpose of deciding whether we scored 7 out of 10 or 6 out of 10, but from the purpose of actually knowing what happened. How did I make that mistake? As one grows older, one finds oneself asking that question more and more. You know, I don't know how I could have done it. And God can offer us a narrative that's bigger than the one we can put together. A narrative of ourselves which is bound up in what he's done for us in Jesus Christ. And that is the narrative that his judgment offers us, if we will accept it. We can refuse it.
Thanks. Your presentation was really great. It was incredible. I sort of feel we need to divide up to 10 and go through each point separately. But obviously, we don't have time to do that. So I'm going to put forward a question to you with how you've used the word doubt. And obviously, you've used it in a very expansive way, and my question might sort of miss what you're getting at, but the question's twofold. Firstly, in the philosophy of religion, one of the criticisms that's put against belief in God is this idea of divine hiddenness. That is, if God would want us to believe in him, and more specifically, if we were in some way culpable for not believing in him, then he should have made himself more obvious. Okay. The second part of the question is to do with doubt concerning sin as to what a sin is. And that can be seen especially in the current state of the Anglican Church, to do with the ethical issues of women and priesthood and homosexuality. The question of doubt towards what is right and wrong. So my question is, one, do you ever just think in terms of these kind of things that God, you know, should have made it more obvious, you know, in terms of his existence, and that would have sorted out our need to doubt. And also just in terms of, so that's in terms of the divine hiddenness thing, but in terms of what sin is, in terms of the how obvious it is, what sin is. And then secondly, how culpability is then related to that doubt in light of divine hiddenness, in light of the complexity of the question of right and wrong, especially in these issues.
Thank you. That's quite a searching question, and goes a long way. I won't be able to do it justice. Let's get clear from the beginning that doubt, as I was deliberately picking it up, and I think you were responding to this, but also trying to widen it, doubt is a practical disposition. I mean, I'm thinking of James, he that doubts is like, doubt is the opposition of faith. Doubt is not simply the abstract propositional doubt that,
X, Y, Z, that, P.
Now, how doubt that, P, affects doubt in the more existential and total and practical sense is another question that I can't go into.
Sure.
But I would just want to say that nobody doubts that something, or whether something, who does not also respond to that doubt practically. That is to say, we are never beings that simply entertain hypotheses or proposals and think about them. We are always at the same time active beings. And those propositions, or with the degree of assent we can give to them or otherwise, are challenging us to react in a certain way. There are various points at which we can say, I do not know whether X is the case or Y is the case. I mean, perhaps if we were completely honest with ourselves and open, we would realize that perhaps 99.9% of the time we might have to say that. Most of the time, these doubts, nevertheless, these uncertainties, these things that we aren't quite sure whether they are thus or so, allow us to chart a course of action. We are not so uncertain that we cannot act. To find ourselves brought to a stand, unable to make our minds up what to do because we just don't know something, is actually the rarer occasion. It's the thing that stands out in our experience. That we may doubt whether God is real, I suppose most people who have thought about God have entertained that doubt. I mean, I certainly have. I don't know how one would think God without asking oneself, but is it real or is it not real? I mean, that is just part of the process of thinking God. That one will doubt that, in that doubt, that P sense, does not mean that one has to stop still in life and do nothing about it and wait. And most things we may reasonably be uncertain about allow us ways of seeking to go forward in a way that will open them up to us. You raised what you take to be, and I take to be genuine uncertainties about how to think sexuality, for example, that prevail among Christians in the Church of England. And those, I take it that those uncertainties frequently are genuine and not pretend. There are ways in which we can explore them. There are ways in which we can test our trains of thought, develop our trains of thought, tackle uncertainties in the way uncertainties have to be tackled, finding out, reflecting on consistency, seeing what implications are, all the processes of thought that we use to sift such uncertainties in the normal course of life. And those are open to us as ways forward. The doubter, one might say, is the person who digs his heels in and says, no, I can't risk opening all that up. I'm just going to have an affirmation and shout it, because that's all I can do. That is the person who is actually shrinking from engaging with the question and the uncertainty. So now that came a long way around to where you were.
And so the one who doubts that P, he, in what you're saying, he doesn't seem to be falling into the category of the doubter that shrinks.
It doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if I find myself doubting whether such and such is the case, suppose somebody comes to me and says, you know your boss is conspiring to try and get you out of the job. Make sure you're sacked.
Right.
And, well, the person who told me ought to be well informed. On the other hand, the person who told me may not be well informed and may be malevolent. And when I think one way or the other, the way my boss has behaved, so on, I simply do not know what the truth is. Whether this is a lie or a truth. I do not have to be paralyzed by that situation.
Yeah.
There are ways I can think about honestly tackling it.
Your three-part, your threefold part of agency there with, I've lost it here on my thing, but corresponding to something, faith, love, and hope, and then it was folly, and the second aspect of that was kind of the external world as the world we see it. And I'm just wondering if you could just give an example of how that plays out in the same sort of typology of sin, or the same, I don't know if typology is very weird.
I think when exploring the sins of folly and there are a number of steps that have to be filled in at this point. And I was aware that I was offering you a sort of a very big schema with very little detail to it at that point. And I'm sorry about that. It's just
you want to get home to your bed tonight. So do I. I think the thing that may have piqued your curiosity, and you've not quite known what I was saying, has to do with the relationship between love and wisdom at this point. Love is love of reality, love of a being, and love under a description. This is something supremely that Augustine can teach us. We love any object for what it is and for our understanding of it, and our love grows as our understanding grows. The sins of folly are very often the sins that involve what might call an indifferent and uncaring assessment of something. The sins of the quick glance and the short sight. We take a quick glance, see how we think it is, and we don't care enough, really, to get to know the object better, to think about what there might be there, and that is a failure of love. We treat the objects of the world as largely indifferent to us, and ourselves as indifferent to them. We have a little place for them in our description of the world, which would be very superficial, and that's as far as we ever go. And that leads us to make great mistakes. The best example is the one I think I gave at the beginning, of when I hate my enemy because I have failed to understand my enemy deeply as a lost child of God. I don't care to know about this man. He really is revolting. And why would I spend time trying to get to understand how a child of God might get into that position when, as it were, I can move on much quicker to the next bit of life if I just think of him as a child of the devil? I've got to love him enough at least to sort of look rather hard at what's made all this, where it comes from, what his problems are. And the sins of love are the sins that, the sins of folly are the sins that come from a lack of sufficient love of the goods God has put in the world around us and in one another to do that. Now I could spend some time talking about these sins, and I've several splendid rants along these lines that one day, if you're not careful, you might get in the way of. I won't go into them now.
You've sort of answered it, but just reflecting on essentially a sin of involvement with something which is a lot bigger than this oneself, sometimes very remote, and just obviously that regret at being at that failure, essentially that straight, that is a very good perspective to start from. It stops you from trying to either distance yourself or feel overly guilty of that, but just the plain fact of failure. I mean, I'm thinking of the South African stories of racism, of divided society, and all those sorts of things, which are somewhat secondary in terms of. But maybe you could just say about the perspective that you should have for sins which you're part of, but not in such a direct way. It's actually tempting to just provide a barrier between you and those.
I do think that taking the trouble to talk about failure, both one's own personal failure and the failures with which one is involved as a member of a society, our corporate, collective things, is very important simply as a moral discipline. I mean, it seems to me
One of the things that most worries me about Western society is that if I should knock my car into somebody else's car, the first thing I think of is the lawyer's advice, never admit liability. Don't say sorry. Don't dare say sorry. They can't get you out of it if you say sorry. You know that. And put that up on the bigger scale, and you know that all the politicians coming to the election are all governed by the same rule. They can never say sorry. They can never really admit failure. Now, there are moments at which, as it were, tactical sorry saying can be introduced into the game as a way to try and get a problem out of the way, to depotentiate it when it really threatens to overthrow you. But we know that this is not a serious attention to failure. Christians have something to say about the relationship of failure to beginnings and to agency. They have something to say very important about the fact nobody ever did anything except out of a record of failure. Nobody was ever given to achieve it who hadn't first, who didn't start from having messed up. And it seems to me this is very fundamental. It needs to be at the basis of our moral thinking. The almost subconscious attempt to protect ourselves from this because it's awkward and we fear it creates insecurity in us, which it does, but only so that we can look for our security in a better place, a proper place, is very crucial. It's the other side, of course, of, as it were, the traditional Pharisaic satisfaction with good words. I am the person who has achieved this, I have achieved that, I have achieved the following. I can't be all bad, there must be something right. Somewhere in my youthful childhood I must have done something good. Ghastly little ditty. The answer is no. The gifts of God are never given to good people. And this has to be fundamental to any moral thinking. How we build it in is critical. Always challenging this assumption that we can't deal with sin as a proposition, as a presupposition. I don't know whether that addresses your question. Maybe
it was something of an observation as well. So
yeah. Well, I'm grateful for it.
Thanks.
Just a question. I wonder if you have any doubt yourself about the sort of starting point of evil always being nothingness. It seems like you can come up with plenty of cases where it seems like evil takes on a bit of a life of its own and perversion sort of builds on itself. And then I suppose there's the traditional Christian affirmation of that there is personally evil. Is sort of turning to metaphysics to sort of say evil is always privation of good. Does that sort of make you have to work pretty hard to sort of retell stories where it does seem like there's evil is active? So just wondering if there's...
No, I don't think it does. No. I think what it makes you work hard at is seriously understanding sin as history. I always take my direction here from Revelation 4 and 5, in which you get the vision of the perfectly ordered creation in Revelation 4, the throne of God and the Lamb, the glassy sea, all everything quiet, all the orders of beings praising God uninterruptedly. And then the mysterious scroll, which is in the hands of the one upon the throne. The scroll that nobody can read and nobody can open. Now that is his way of trying to differentiate, as it were, what is the being, the goodness of what is, from the ambiguity and threateningness of what happens. It's a relationship of being to event that we have to get clear. And it seems to me the best way of speaking about the status of evil, say in the thought of St. John the Divine, is in the silly little phrase, stuff happens. It is in that scroll of events. It is what is done and what follows from what is done. Now there are chains of necessity that unroll from evil. Everyone knows that. Half the problems we face are made by other people's mistakes back then. We're very good at denouncing and saying they should never have done that, they should never have got us in this position. And then half the problems our children will face are the mistakes we're making now. And we have a nasty suspicion of that, so then we shut up. The key being, however, that it is not the ordered goodness of the world that is touched by this. It is the dimensions of time and history. That's the distinction I think one is forced to make and think quite hard about. It is within history that there is sin, it is within history that there is disaster, it is in history that there is redemption. And that is why, in the end, at the very heart of our faith, is an event in history. The event of the cross and resurrection. And nowhere else would do. I don't know whether that addresses the question. I think the metaphysical, the ontological, sort of Platonic way of putting it, that appealed to Augustine and to Maximus Confessor and so on, is a way of trying to use that language to grip onto the imagery of Revelation. And I believe one can find similar imagery in the Old Testament. A sense that it is history which poses all the moral ambiguities, and it's within history we have to deal with it anyway. It's a doctrine, say, that the author of the book Ecclesiastes would feel quite comfortable with. To take one.
Well, I think we'd probably better let wrap things up there, and if you have any further questions, maybe you can chat with Professor O'Donovan afterwards for a couple of minutes. And let's thank him once again. Well, thank you. I'm Joseph.